final investigator I met with was pathologist Dr. Randy Gascoigne from the British Columbia Cancer Agency. And to begin, I asked him to put in perspective the global issue of hematologic pathology in the community hospital setting.
So there's no question that for the average pathologist who's out in the community and is seeing the whole spectrum from cancer to inflammatory disease to infectious disease, the actual classification of lymphoid cancers is probably the most challenging thing they have to do. And quite honestly, the issue is really one about seeing a critical volume, having a level of expertise. And so maybe the best way to frame it is to think about somebody sitting in a smaller community who's looking at an appendectomy specimen, looking at a gallbladder, looking at a products of conception, and then along comes some kind of lymphoid cancer. And that presents a real challenge to them, both in terms of their experience and then having a test menu that would allow them to actually analyze the case in the appropriate detail. To put it in context, somebody like myself did nothing but lymphoma for just sort of 30 years. And so I looked at nothing. So there'd be things that I would see 15 times in a week that somebody in the community might see once every 6 to 12 months. And so what that's trying to highlight really is that there's no question that in terms of value for money, that having your biopsy of a lymphoid cancer reviewed by somebody with good expertise in the field is probably an extremely important thing to consider and to probably pursue.
Can you talk a little bit about how you, as an expert in this area, kind of think through the issue of the specimen, the adequacy of the specimen, and some of the critical features that you're going to focus on?
Yeah, so for someone making lymphoid cancer diagnoses, the most important thing is it wasn't uncommon for me to be sent things that were called malignant that in fact were benign. And so that's probably a fairly critical determinant. And as someone with expertise in the field, the other real key is to not be shy about saying that if a biopsy is insufficient or inadequate, that you're not doing the patient or the treating clinician any favors if you're trying to shoehorn a diagnosis with something like that, when the reality is it's simply inadequate. So it's very important that you be able, at the end of every day, one of the things I used to pride myself on is I didn't like going home unless I was 99% confident of every single case that I saw that I was able to actually reach, you know, a definitive diagnosis. So I think that what's really critical is don't be afraid to say you're not sure. So if something is small or something is largely inadequate as a sample, don't be shy about saying that it's insufficient for an adequate diagnosis and recommend that consideration be given to a repeat biopsy that's a little more generous proportions. That's a very important thing for pathologists to do, but I will tell you that a lot of my colleagues are shy about doing that because there's this automatic feeling of being inadequate if you can't make a diagnosis on the material that you're given. But in fact, asking for repeat biopsy is not a bad thing. It's in everybody's interests.
What about technical issues in doing the assay or just looking at the specimen in terms of crush artifact, poor fixation, or excessive fixation?
Yeah, so those are all big issues. And quite honestly, where they become even more important is in the whole area of needle core biopsies. I will tell you that if you look at the quality of core biopsies, they span an entire spectrum. Some of them are actually quite generous. They're a fairly decent gauge in terms of size and the quality with which they're processed is good. But I have seen thousands of cores where they are small, they're crushed. You always get an edge effect. And the other big issue with them is that to make an accurate diagnosis of a complex lymphoma, you often have to have a reasonable test menu. And the problem with needle core biopsies is you can rapidly exhaust that tissue so that you can't do all the available tests you want to do. And so fixation is important. All of those issues, which quite honestly, all aspects of pathology require that you have a reasonable piece of tissue, that it's well preserved, it's adequately fixed, and it's properly processed. So for needle core biopsies, that can be quite a challenge. And I will tell you that after 29 years of doing this, I was never a big fan of needle core biopsies. And quite frankly, in particular, with palpable nodes that I could take out, or you, Dr. Love. So these are things that are easily accessible. I would prefer to see an incisional biopsy or even an excisional biopsy in contrast to a needle core.
So you mentioned cases where actually the diagnosis was not cancer. How often does that occur? And what are some of the conditions that are confused with cancer?
Well, quite honestly, probably the most common thing I used to see early in my career is being able to distinguish what we call reactive follicular hyperplasia, which is often not, or does not have a concrete etiology. It's often sort of nonspecific, nothing obvious, no infection, no other sort of underlying cause, but the lymph nodes can be quite generous. And you take those out and they have a nodular architecture and they're made up of follicles. And if there's a lot of them, they can easily mimic follicular lymphoma. And so early in my career, which is quite true, you know, in contrast to later in my career, I used to see a lot of cases. And you can well imagine the significance of that. If a patient is referred in as having follicular lymphoma, and you can happily tell the treating clinician and the patient that in fact it's a benign diagnosis, that's a big deal. So that's a common scenario. What other diagnosis? Sometimes Hodgkin lymphoma, when it has lots of granulomas in the background, that can easily be missed. Certain types of non-Hodgkin lymphomas can be a challenge. And again, it's made even more difficult by small biopsies. So if the biopsies are more generous, usually you're able to resolve that aspect of the diagnosis, which is really critical.
So can you talk a little bit about how you approach or how should be approached the issues of additional assays beyond histopathology and how that varies based on what you see histopathologically and what the clinical status is?
Yeah, so I'm primarily a morphologist by trade. So when I started out early in my career, it's all about looking down the microscope at a good H&E stain slide and being able to formulate a differential diagnosis. And if lymphoma is on that diagnosis, then usually the next sort of steps are immunohistochemistry, for which we have a very large test menu these days. You can do almost everything you can, but keep in mind that you have to have sufficient tissue in order to lay out your test menu to be able to get those things done. There is a role for flow cytometry. I worked in a center where we flowed everything that was considered to be lymphoma. So it would be submitted and we would set it up for flow cytometry. That has a lot of value because you can often get a pretty good idea what you're dealing with within the first 2 or 3 hours of receiving it. We used to do a lot of cytogenetics. You don't do so much now because you can do what's called FISH, which stands for fluorescence in situ hybridization, and you can do that on routine paraffin material. And then also molecular biology. Sometimes the determination of clonality is an important ancillary test. So if you're on the edge between, am I sure this is benign or malignant? If you're able to document that there's a B-cell clone there, that's an additional useful piece of information that might help sway you towards a diagnosis of a malignancy. So those are some of the tests that we would do. And in any given case, the complexity of a test will be dependent on what we think the morphology shows us. If it's a straightforward follicular lymphoma, you might need only a little immunohistochemistry and you've nailed the diagnosis and you've done it with confidence. Something else, you might need molecular biology, you might be glad you had the flow cytometry, et cetera, because the case is more complicated.
So you mentioned IHC. Can you talk a little bit about the pitfalls of IHC and variations that occur?
Sure. So probably I would categorize them into three big categories where mistakes happen. The number one category is people don't order the test. So if you don't order the test, you are not going to know the status of expression of any given antigen by cells in the microenvironment or by the tumor if you haven't ordered it. So that's number one. I see that all the time. The second thing is the test is ordered, but it's technically inadequate. And oftentimes a good lymphoma pathologist will be able to recognize whether there's staining that you can see in some of the background cells to know that the stain was adequate. So that's the second big area, you know, is related to technical issues on the basis of the lab that's performing the test. And then the third category, surprisingly enough, but again, this is where the expertise comes in, is the test was ordered, the test was done well, but the test was misinterpreted. And that has to do with weak staining, that has to do with staining of cells that aren't the malignant cells, and the interpretation that in fact it was the cancer cells, et cetera.
Can you talk a little bit about the specific IHC tests and panels that are commonly done in patients with lymphoma?
Yeah, so in many laboratories, as I mentioned early on, there is quite a large test menu now. And so if a lab is seeing a lot of lymphoma, they're going to stock most of the reagents that are needed to have quite a large test menu. In some institutions, well, it's what I used to call a shotgun approach, and I've never been in favor of that. So what I would do is I would look down the microscope at an H&E, and I would say, I think I know what this is. And so what do I need to actually order in order to definitively establish that diagnosis. And if there's some relevant negatives or pertinent negatives, I would order them as well. So I never worked in a lab where I would just order a whole panel of things without considering what I think the diagnosis is. And so we were always quite limited in what we did, and that's a cost-efficient way to do it. But remember, I did nothing but lymphoma. So in a lab that's doing more general pathology, they'll have a small number of tests that make up their lymphoma diagnosis category. And they'll do them oftentimes in tiers. So they may have a tier one sort of screening panel that has a B-cell marker, a T-cell marker, has a leukocyte common antigen to know that you're dealing with something in the white blood cell series, so to speak. And they'll have a couple of other markers, EMA sometimes, maybe a keratin. So that's a first sort of screening pass. And then depending on how those look within 24 hours, they'll have those tests out. And then depending on how they look, they might make the decision then to do some more tests that will inform more on exactly the specific diagnosis. I never practiced that way. And so what I would do is, as I said, is I would look down the microscope, and if I think it's a certain type of lymphoma, I would order A, B, C, D in order to establish that.
I want to focus a little bit on some of the assays that have clinical importance in terms of deciding on therapies. And one in particular that's been a lot of interest and a lot of work done over the years is CD30 testing. Can you talk about what CD30 is, how it's tested for? Of course, obviously, right now, the clinical implications is the potential use of B-Vedotin. But can you talk about what we know about to what extent CD30 testing is done, how it's done, and what we know in terms of the quality of the work that's done?
Yeah, absolutely. So CD30 is a very common antigen, but it's expressed on activated lymphoid cells. But it's also additionally expressed on some malignant cells as well. So it's commonly expressed in Reed-Sternberg cells and Hodgkin lymphoma, for instance. It's expressed in anaplastic large cell lymphoma, both ALK negative and ALK positive. And then it can be sprinkled across a number of other tumors where you do get some CD30 expression. The most common way to measure it is using immunohistochemistry, and the most common antibody is an antibody we used to call BRH2 back in the old days. It's not a sophisticated test to do, but you would be surprised based on some of the QC programs from around the world that overall, in fact, across a large number of laboratories, it is not done that well in a large number of laboratories. And it has to do with the choice of the antibody. There are a number of different clones available, and some people choose clones that are a little bit insensitive, a little bit finicky to work with, and so their results can be questionable. The antibody has to be diluted just right. You have to actually do the test in an optimal way to optimize preservation of the antigen and being able to detect its expression. And then, as we were saying before, in addition to doing all that technically appropriate, you have to then be able to interpret the results as well. So there are a lot of issues in spite of the fact, I would consider it a fairly routine and simple antibody to do by immunohistochemistry. It still can be a challenge for some labs. And so those are the labs that need to pay attention to QC programs, to using internal controls, to using additional external controls on the slides to be able to control for the quality of staining. There are a small number of labs in the world that are now running it as a routine using flow cytometry, but that's a limited number. We began doing that about 4 years ago, but a lot of labs in North America are not running that in flow cytometry.
How is the assay read out? Is it percent positive cells? And do you also report on the type of staining, whether it's cytoplasmic or diffuse?
Yeah, so both of those things, in terms of the latter question you're asking me about the interpretation of the staining pattern, it's important to report that. In most of the cases, it is membranous and then also stains the Golgi within the cells too. So it produces very large dot-like staining pattern as well as the membrane. It's important to determine whether the expression is on benign or malignant cells based on your interpretation of the H&E and the immunohistochemical stain. And then it is worthwhile nowadays because it is a target. And as you mentioned, we now have a drug that specifically targets that. It's important to say something about the percentage of malignant cells that are expressing the antigen. And that becomes quite important because in due course, clinical people will start to be making decisions and actual clinical trials will be informed by knowing the percentage of malignant cells that are seen to be expressing.
So in other words, it's not just positive or negative?
That's actually not very valuable information to put out, this positive or negative. You really want to save. So by way of example, in a case of peripheral T-cell lymphoma, what we refer to as PTCL unspecified, you can see some CD30 expression. Not at all uncommon. But it's usually a few cells, maybe 20, 30% of the cells, so it's not very uniform and not that strong. If you contrast that with anaplastic large cell lymphoma, either ALK negative or ALK positive, that is strongly positive on 100% of the cells. That's an important distinction. One, because it's useful information potentially for the clinician, but also it helps you with the differential diagnosis.
I am kind of curious because it's kind of been a little bit confusing to me. I know there was some work done in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that showed no correlation between CD30 or the presence of it and, you know, benefit by B-vedotin. It's kind of hard to, you know, kind of get that in perspective. What's your take on that?
So I think if we're going to ever have consistency to diagnoses and to determining some of these things, we need a uniform and consistent way of reporting the findings. So I strongly recommend that pathologists actually get together and actually detail criteria of how the staining will be interpreted and how it will be reported. Because over time, we will learn whether even small amounts of expression are clinically relevant and have anything to do with being able to gauge responses. So there aren't really formal criteria nowadays. That's something, unfortunately, that happens in medicine in general and in pathology. And I would argue that we need those criteria. We need to develop them fairly soon so they can be consistently applied.
So I'm thinking about, again, hematologic cancers, lymphomas, CLL, where there are secondary assays or assays beyond histopathology that really have a huge impact on what people do. Just yesterday, I was doing an interview and we were talking about management of chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And I'm curious about your thoughts about, again, the work up there in those patients, and particularly now that we've seen the evolution of drugs like ibrutinib and venetoclax, the importance of FISH testing and identification of 17P patients.
Yeah. So in most laboratories who have a reasonable volume of lymphoid cancers, and CLL being by far the most common type of leukemia we see in adults, those kind of tests need to be available to allow clinicians to inform on choices for therapy. So besides the morphology, which is relevant to some extent in CLL, although it's hard to miss a diagnosis, but can be confused with other types of lymphoid cancers when they're in the peripheral blood. The next best thing is flow cytometry. That, in most cases, will give you a very solid look at the phenotype of the cells and the actual percentage of malignant cells. And then FISH testing is fairly standard. Those are kits. So to be able to look at gains of 12, the 11 Qs, the 17 Ps, et cetera, that's a standard FISH kit. And that can be easily optimized to work very well and becomes very important to one to have the test done and to report it properly. So in this day and age, if you're in a lab that's seeing a reasonable volume of lymphoid cancers, you need to be doing all of those things. In addition now, the ability to look at specific genes in terms of mutation profiles is also becoming very important in the laboratory.
You mentioned other diseases, lymphomas that can be confused with CLL. The one I've heard about is mantle cell, but what are the situations where that happens?
So quite honestly, the CLL mantle cell thing can be a challenge in some cases. Both are CD5 positive B cell disorders, but there are subtle differences that unless you have a lot of experience, they're actually morphological differences that distinguish them. They're subtle, but they're true. There are phenotypic differences related to the density of CD20, the density of immunoglobulin, the co-expression of CD23, co-expression of another marker that is called FMC-7, etc. There are lots of tools we use in flow cytometry to distinguish those things. I have seen circulating follicular lymphoma where somebody has been misdiagnosed as CLL. That's a tumor that often expresses CD10, is usually CD5 negative. I don't believe that you shouldn't be calling anything CLL if it lacks expression of CD5. I would question the diagnosis. So there are actually other entities that can be confused. Prolymphocytic leukemia, although a rare disease, can express CD5 and can be confused. The morphology to me is totally different. And the antigen expression profile is different. But as you know, that's an aggressive type of leukemia in contrast to CLL. So the distinction becomes quite important.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about what we know right now about the incidence of misdiagnosis or misclassification in clinical practice. I believe you had brought up three studies, and maybe you could go through what each one of them looked at, what they saw, and what you think it means.
So the study that I sent you first was the 2012 publication from Memorial Sloan Kettering, I believe published in Annals of Oncology. And that set out to do something very simple. It said, you know, as a tertiary referral center, let's look at the diagnoses that are coming in that accompany the patients when they're referred. And let's compare 2001, when we were using an old version of the WHO, and then let's compare that or contrast that with what happened after 2006. There was an iteration of the WHO in 2006, and virtually every practicing pathologist would have that book in their office and could refer to it. And so the assumption was that after 2006, in fact, the misdiagnosis and misclassification would largely dwindle because people had access to the WHO. And essentially what that study did is it looked at a large number of cases from 2001 and after 2006, and it reached the conclusion that roughly 15% in either era are still being misdiagnosed. And so that even with clarifications that came from the WHO iteration 2006, we weren't seeing improvements. And quite honestly, I would go back to a point that I made to you early on, is that you have to remember that the people at MSK who were doing lymphoma were like me. Those people largely did nothing but lymphoma. And so to an average pathologist, somebody being biopsied out in the community, again, this is, you know, having a diagnosis assigned by somebody who's going to see one of these every 6 months. When you're sitting in, you know, in the middle of New York, you're seeing 15 of these a week. So there is a big issue about the body of experience that allows accurate diagnosis. The other issue, which is important, of course, is test menu. The people at MSK would have a very complex, up-to-date test menu to resolve some of the diagnostic discrepancies, where the people in the community largely wouldn't. I will tell you that the way I practice, and I'm here in Canada, is that most of the people in this province trying to make those diagnoses wouldn't even bother to put in significant effort. They would just send the case and let me do the bells and whistles that were required to arrive at a definitive diagnosis. I think, again, that that is in the interest of the treating clinician and the patient to take advantage of a referral service to someone with expertise to establish an accurate diagnosis.
You said that about 15% of these cases at Memorial, there was a misdiagnosis. Can you kind of classify where those 15% came from?
Yeah, so my recollection that in that paper, they did list, I don't have it at my fingertips, and I remember that they do list some of the common discrepancies that occurred that led to misdiagnoses. I think perhaps the more important paper is the one from British Journal of Hematology that came from the University of Nebraska Medical Center. That was published in 2014, and that one has a couple of very important points to it. They analyzed, I think it was like 6 months worth of referrals, over 1,000 cases, and they again achieved a misdiagnosis around the 15% sort of level. And as I recall in that paper, they did, you know, again, highlight some of the types of misdiagnoses, misclassification, including a small number of things that go from benign to malignant or vice versa, or the other way. Those are incredibly relevant, of course, not surprisingly. But the other big thing that they published in that paper that was highly relevant is that 88% of the cases where there was a misclassification or a misdiagnosis, 88% of those led to a treatment difference, which is huge when you think about it. And so again, I would go back to, you know, try to emphasize as firmly as I can that, and I hope I don't upset any of my clinical colleagues who treat patients, is that I think that the single most important second opinion in oncology is to have a review of your biopsy with someone who has critical expertise in the field. I think that is value for money without doubt, so that the treating clinician then knows exactly what they're treating. And the treatment plan, the expectation of survival, all of the other things that flow from that are so critical. If you can start with a hugely confident diagnosis in a difficult area.
One of the things I see that they looked at or found in this paper was a difference in grading of follicular lymphoma. Can you talk about that and what we know about inter-observer variation? Because that certainly is an important factor in treatment decisions.
Yeah, so my own bias is that within a single institution, if there are two or three pathologists who do lymphoma, if you take those people and establish a priori criteria, you can have pretty consistent scoring between observers. Now, quite honestly, you know, my clinical colleagues would argue that between grade 1 and grade 3A, it's probably not that clinically relevant to do that. I believe from the perspective of clinical research, it is important to get those things consistently right. The problem comes when you look across institutions, that there's no really good agreement on how to do that. We established scoring criteria in the WHO. They're very clearly laid out. The problem is that the average pathologist trying to distinguish what is known as a follicular dendritic cell, which is an antigen-presenting cell in either benign or malignant follicles, can look very much like a large cell, what we call a centroblast. And so the actual enumeration, I would agree with you completely, is not very reproducible. But I would think that within a given center, if everybody's on board with having established criteria and they're agreed upon before people start looking at cases, you will get quite good agreement in terms of grading. And I think it has relevance for clinical research, not necessarily in terms of being able to plan treatments for patients.
So let's go through some of the cases you brought in today, beginning with your 32-year-old woman.
Yep. So this was a case that I actually saw. These are all real cases. There was a biopsy done on the outside, which is common to the center I worked in. It did not do a lot of oncologic surgery. So we weren't establishing the primary diagnosis in many of the cases. We were being referred in. And so the case was biopsied on the outside. They did some immunohistochemistry, and they referred the case in as a case of peripheral T-cell lymphoma. They had done some immunohistochemistry, and they had interpreted their results and made their diagnosis on the basis of the immunohistochemistry. But quite honestly, we looked at, just by way of example, we looked at the CD30 stain. And the CD30 stain did not have any staining of the small number of plasma cells and things in the background that should be expressing. And so immediately we questioned the technical quality of the stain. It was not uncommon in my practice to repeat stains, even though they appeared to be good and appeared to be from the outside, we would repeat them and get completely different results. So we did a CD30 stain, and it was uniformly and strongly positive. So the diagnosis made on the outside of peripheral T-cell lymphoma was on the basis of their interpretation of a technically inadequate stain, unfortunately. So they missed what was obvious, that this was actually a case of anaplastic large cell lymphoma. Once we established that, we did an ALK stain, which is the next important stain to do, to determine if it's ALK positive or ALK negative. In this case, it was ALK negative. So the ALK was negative. So this was a case of ALK negative anaplastic large cell lymphoma and not a case of peripheral T-cell lymphoma. On the basis of that, which is not uncommon in cases with types of T-cell lymphoma, including ALK negative ALCL, the patient was enrolled in a clinical trial and offered an experimental drug that was appropriate for that diagnosis. So that was a game changer there. That's someone who went from PTCL to anaplastic large cell lymphoma, ALK negative.
What about the histopathology in the case? Did it look like anaplastic large cell lymphoma?
Yeah. So again, those are some of the subtleties, Dr. Love, of looking at cases where you don't have a lot of experience. Anaplastic large cell lymphoma has a characteristic morphology. We get cells that are called hallmark cells that can be tricky to people who don't see them all the time. But if you see them 15 times a week, they jump out at you. It has often sinusoidal involvement. It can look like a metastatic carcinoma if it's in the subcapsular sinus. It can look cohesive. There's all kinds of changes that we see. It's highly mitotic. It really does have a characteristic morphology to the experienced eye. And then with a good CD30 stain, what jumps out is that every single cell is strongly and uniformly positive. So it makes the diagnosis easy in experienced hands. In people who are less experienced, it can be a challenge.
As you were mentioning some of those characteristics, I was thinking to myself of where does clinical information, for example, from the medical oncologist, fit in terms of the pathology interpretation?
Sure. So lymphoma pathology is largely a subtype of pathology that requires a really good collaboration with clinical colleagues. My clinical colleagues would talk to me every day about active cases. And that information, we would want that information provided when we're looking at a case, because in a lot of situations, it's actually quite relevant to know the age of the patient, sex of the patient, the presenting symptoms, signs, is there a skin rash, is there hypergammaglobulinemia? All of those kinds of things can be of value in helping you establish your diagnosis. At the end of the day, though, for most lymphoid tumors, it does come down to a good interpretation by an expert in the field of the actual histopathology and the ancillary studies. But you never do that in isolation. You want the clinical information.
Getting back to the issue of CD30 testing, what do we know about whether or not those assay results change with time as the tumor evolves? What do we know about heterogeneity at different locations?
Wow, those are very good questions. I can give you my own experience. There's not a lot published because, as you know, most of the time when a biopsy is done and you're able to render a specific diagnosis, you don't go back and ask the clinicians to biopsy another site. Well, most of the time you don't. There may be rare occasions when you might need to. So there's very little evidence in the literature. I would base most of my evidence on looking at recurrent disease, for which I have more experience. And again, that's the tincture of time and who knows what that could do. But in my experience, cell of origin, CD30, those are things that tend to be fairly robust and they're usually maintained. You know, I won't be surprised that over time, as people start to biopsy people who have been given brentuximab vedotin, there will be some scenarios begin to develop where actually selection has occurred on the basis of cells not expressing it anymore. And so we saw that with CD20 and the use of rituximab a little bit. I'm sure we will see it with other more specific therapies. But at the present time, there's very little literature that informs on knowing about heterogeneity and at the time of relapse.
That's really interesting what you were mentioning in terms of after treatment with B-vedotin. What happens when you, for example, I would guess it's something like anaplastic large cell lymphoma, like say you see a partial remission, maybe they progress, I don't know, but I would guess they would still have CD30, but what do we know about that?
We actually don't know a lot. One would make an argument the expression is giving the tumor cells some sort of growth advantage. And the tumor cells know nothing about brentuximab at the time they develop as a malignant tumor in somebody. So presumably it's providing a growth advantage. And so you would think intuitively it ought to be present. And when there's progressive disease or a frank relapse, you'd think it'd still be there. However, you're operating now under selective pressure of treatment, and we just don't know enough about what that might induce in terms of the biology of a recurrence. It would seem reasonable that in the tumor's interest, if it could downregulate CD30 to the point of not being detected or not being present, it might be something that would give the tumor an advantage.
Yeah, you know, the other thing about B-vedotin is interesting, I've wondered about, is you do see some patients who get complete responses. Sometimes they go on for years and years, and it's not the typical case, but it's not rare. And do we know anything about what predicts this kind of good response? Do you see it with more CD30 expression? Are there other markers or clinical factors?
Not that I am aware of. So the majority of cases, if we restrict the discussion to cases of ALCL, whether they're ALK negative or ALK positive, CD30 is expressed by virtually every cell and very strongly. And so why some patients will enter remission probably has much more to do with the underlying biology and the genetics and not to do with the phenotypic expression of a single marker like CD30. And so there are probably lots of reasons, mostly biological. There's also the patient-related ones, right, that you would know about in terms of comorbidities and patient age and all those usual things too, which will have an impact. But at the end of the day, I think we know little about that. That's quite honestly a subject for future investigations. That'll be very important.
So let's hear about your 47-year-old man.
Yep. So this is a 47-year-old man who presented with lymphadenopathy and anemia. And there was a biopsy of a neck node, and an outside diagnosis of PTCL was made. Patient was referred to my center where, as you can see, pathology review as well as the treatment decision go hand in hand. There's absolutely no clinician in my center who would even see a patient without the pathology being reviewed by the experts in our center. And in this particular case, you can see why that's relevant. So we did some additional immunohistochemistry, and we turned that diagnosis from a PTCL to actually a case of T-cell and histiocyte-rich B-cell lymphoma, a completely different entity. And in part, the reason there was an issue is that the pathologist in a small center didn't recognize that although 99% of the cells were T cells, they weren't the malignant cells, they're the benign cells in the background. The malignant cells were scattered amongst that. And you would think that's an easy diagnosis to make or a distinction to make, but it actually can be a challenge. They did a bone marrow in this case, and as we and quite honestly others have published, the cases of T-cell-rich B-cell lymphoma have very frequent bone marrow involvement. In fact, 6 times to what we would see in garden variety DLBCL. And so the treatment was changed, in fact, from CHOP to being treated with R-CHOP, and the patient entered a remission. So very critical. Again, these are subtle diagnostic distinctions, and to the average eye, you're looking at something that's 99% T-cell. So it's not really a shock that somebody might think that's a T-cell lymphoma, when in fact the malignant cells only represent 1% of the biopsy. That's a similar challenge to what we see in Hodgkin lymphoma, as you can imagine.
Sounds like Hodgkin lymphoma. Can you talk more about TCR-BCL, how frequently it occurs, how it presents? It seems like it would be ripe for misdiagnosis.
Yeah, it is fairly ripe for misdiagnosis. It's not a very common diagnosis, probably certainly less than 1% of what we see, but in a busy center, and that's still a few cases every year. As mentioned, it's predominantly males in the sort of 40 to 60-year-old range. They often present with advanced stage disease. Involvement of the liver and spleen is very common, and involvement of the bone marrow, as we reported many years ago, is extremely common in this disease. It clearly has a relationship to nodular lymphocyte predominant Hodgkin lymphoma, but the exact relationship is still somewhat a matter of controversy. It is a disease that would be within the category of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. It's a specific subtype. It can be very rich in histiocytes as well as reactive T-cells, and that's the name. And And it responds well. We published a paper in JCO many years ago where probably stage of disease might be the most important determinant in terms of looking at its curability. But it needs to be treated with R-CHOP as opposed to CHOP for something that's PTCL.
Since you introduced this issue of classification of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, can you talk a little bit more about how you view that?
Well, I think the most common subtype of DLBCL is what we refer to as not otherwise specified, so-called DLBCL-NOS. That is by far the most common type that we see. The others are actually quite a long list, and it's a growing list that'll be coming out in about a month in the actual print version of the new WHO. I got an email just the other day that we're expecting the book out in early September, so we will be seeing it finally. There's a very long list of other subtypes, but what they do is they add complexity for the average pathologist in terms of sorting out those subtypes, but at the end of the day, they're recognizable subtypes of DLBCL. If we return then to the most common variety, the so-called generic DLBCL, there's at least two diseases in there, at least two diseases. And we know those based on a lot of molecular gene expression work that we were involved in and others, but also a whole lot of studies that have come since. And those are the so-called germinal center B versus the activated B. There is a wealth of data that tells us absolutely that the ABC type is a much more aggressive disease. It has characteristic mutational profiles. The biology is becoming more and more resolved. And we know that that subset of DLBCL is probably not adequately served by standard dose sort of R-CHOP. And so we're beginning to do studies where we want to know with great accuracy the cell of origin subtype. Those can be determined using immunohistochemistry, but actually my lab produced an assay together with our colleagues in the what's called the LLMPP, which we published now several times, where there's low density gene expression assays that can be used to very robustly be able to stratify those as GCB and ABC. And I will remind the people watching this that that distinction is now strongly recommended, if in fact not required. When you make a diagnosis of DLBCL, you need to report on the cell of origin and you need to use the best available technology to do that. The assay that we developed, so-called Lymph2CX, I believe there's a commercial name now, it is LST, which is lymphoma subtyping test. And that is probably the most robust way to determine GCB versus ABC. But it's becoming highly relevant because we're getting a reasonable menu of treatment options now where distinctions between GCB and ABC are relevant because they're only enrolling one or the other types of patients, those patients in clinical trials, and the expectation of outcome is highly dictated by that.
Can you talk about other less common subtypes of diffuse large B-cell, including the so-called double hit?
So I'd been doing this for roughly 29, 30 years, but I can recall speaking very strongly at a meeting in France in 2008 that I thought the determination of the status of the three oncogenes in terms of translocations in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma was the largest unmet need that we were not routinely performing. That was in 2008. And now in 2017, essentially a requirement. There's no question that there is a subset of cases of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that will harbor translocations of the dominant oncogenes, and they would be MYC being the most important one in combination with BCL2 and or BCL6, so that they can be double hit if they have MYC and BCL2 or MYC and BCL6, or we even see cases of so-called triple hit, and they have all three oncogenes that have been translocated. That leads to the deregulated expression of BCL2, MYC, and BCL6 for that matter, and those tumors behave extremely aggressively. They represent approximately 8 to 10% of all of the diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So not huge in terms of a percentage, but when you think that DLBCL is the most common diagnosis we see, then in a given year, that's actually a lot of cases still. Those cases have a completely different biology and a different clinical course. They are extremely aggressive. We know from all of the published work, including a lot of it from my own group, that R-CHOP as a standard of care for DLBCL, those patients do not do well. They, although we have no prospective data to inform on what the appropriate therapy is, most of my clinical colleagues would agree that dose intensification in the form of dose-adjusted EPOCR, some of the other therapies that are available, Codox MIVAC, et cetera, those are all probably very useful. I don't know whether we will ever get to a point where we actually have prospective data to inform on the best therapy, but there's enough phase two and related data to suggest that R-CHOP alone is not sufficient for those patients, number one. Number two, it's critical to determine them, to determine those actual cases. We have an actual specific category now in the WHO that is to be used for those cases. The only way to pick them up, really, there are no good surrogates. You really have to employ the fish studies in order to find these cases. Some people have advocated using the proliferation rate. Some have advocated that if you know with high confidence that they're GCB, then all the double hits, the MYC-BCL2, will all be within the GCB. So there are some surrogates that can be used, but at the end of the day, in the center I work in, we fish every case of DLBCL or even things that look alike, as in these high-grade B-cell lymphomas.
So your cases you brought here today are really awesome. Let's hear about the 63-year-old lady.
So the 63-year-old lady who had, you know, night sweats and weight loss, and she had lymphadenopathy, full house, as the you guys would say, everywhere. She had some unexplained skin rashes, and also polyclonal gammopathy was noted in some of her blood work, some of her chemistry. There was a biopsy performed in an outside hospital, and a diagnosis of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma was made. And they started her on R-CHOP. But she didn't really respond well to at least the first induction. And so, you know, as would be routine anyway, she was referred to my center. And again, we would review the pathology in great detail. So we looked at the case and we thought, yes, there are definitely some large B cells in here. But with a reasonable complement of additional immunohistochemistry and some molecular genetic testing, we were able to very confidently show that this is actually a form of peripheral T cell lymphoma that is known as angioimmunoblastic type of T cell lymphoma. When you reflect back to the clinical features, skin rash, polyclonal gammopathy, lymphadenopathy, hepatosplenomegaly, those are all common presenting features. It's a very aggressive disease in many of those settings. And so she was switched. In fact, she enrolled on a clinical trial and was switched to a different therapy. Of course, the rituximab would have no role. And what people need to understand, again, if you don't see a lot of that, is having a reasonable component of the tumor that's actually not malignant cells. They're benign large B cells. They often harbor EVV, and they're very characteristic in these tumors, but they're not the malignant cells. They're part of what starts out as probably an atypical immune reaction. And so they'll still be present in the biopsy. But in fact, the diagnosis went from diffuse large B-cell lymphoma to what's called AITL.
So I'm curious, what did the CD20 testing show?
It showed that there were scattered large cells. There weren't sheets of large cells. They were scattered around the biopsy. And when you did the EBER in situ hybridization, those are the same cells that harbored EBV, which is very common in the disease. But in fact, the malignant cells can be characterized as atypical T cells with a very unique phenotype. They have the phenotype of what are known as TH cells, what are called T helper-like cells that are in follicles. And there's a set of markers that we use to characterize those cells. And this tumor was strongly positive for 4 or 5 of those markers. So a very different diagnosis, again, highlighting the need for expertise in making these diagnoses.
So how about your 22-year-old man?
So the 22-year-old... So that's a young gentleman who had adenopathy in the left axilla, and a biopsy again was performed on the outside, and both the patient and the pathology material were referred to our center. The outside diagnosis was referred to as lymphocyte-rich classical Hodgkin lymphoma. Not a very common subtype, but it's part of the spectrum of NS and mixed cellularity, but it's much less common. So we did some additional immunohistochemistry, and we actually revised the diagnosis quite significantly to an uncommon form of Hodgkin lymphoma that is to be distinguished from what we call classical Hodgkin lymphoma, which includes the NS and the mixed cellularities and the lymphocyte rich. We changed the diagnosis on the basis of immunohistochemistry and the morphology to a diagnosis that is known as nodular lymphocyte predominant Hodgkin lymphoma. And that has, there's lots of issues about the appropriate therapy, but it has significant connotations for one, the approach in many centers to the treatment, but also the expectation of survival, the chance of relapse, the actual chance of histologic progression is very different in that rare, only 5% of all Hodgkin lymphoma is nodular lymphocyte predominant, but there are lots of issues about how that might behave clinically. And so we, in fact, changed the diagnosis. That distinction can sometimes be a challenge for many people. That's, to be honest with you, neither of those diagnoses, lymphocyte-rich classical Hodgkin or nodular lymphocyte-predominant Hodgkin, are common diagnoses. They're uncommon. So the average pathologist will not see many of those in a year, if they see any.
You said that the IHC was very important here. What specific assay?
So not really the CD20. The CD20 is expressed in a subset of classical Hodgkin lymphoma. But if we think back about the diagnosis that we established, nodular LP Hodgkin lymphoma, the so-called LP cells, which are scattered amongst macronodules, will express CD20, but they don't express CD15. They don't express CD30. The cells in the microenvironment are very characteristic and different. The LP cells will often express CD79A, another B cell marker that's useful that you almost never see in classical Hodgkin lymphoma. They express BCL6. They can express epithelial membrane antigen and a number of other markers. So if you have a reasonable test menu, you can distinguish them. I actually think that on the basis of H&E with an experienced set of eyes, it's not that hard to make the distinction. Nodular lymphocyte-predominant Hodgkin lymphoma, is really characteristic. When you've seen a lot of it, you can recognize it. And it does look different than cases of lymphocyte-rich classical Hodgkin, although both will have this nodular appearance at low power.
So let's talk about your 65-year-old lady.
So this is a lady who was incidentally found to have lymphocytosis with a count of only 10,000. So we picked up a peripheral blood specimen to do flow cytometry, and that was performed. And once these data were analyzed in a couple of hours of getting the sample, we were able to tell that we have a lambda clonal B cell disorder expressing CD19, CD20, lambda light chains. And the cells also showed co-expression of CD5, CD23, and FMC-7. The patient, for whatever reasons, did not want to have a bone marrow. And so the outside diagnosis, based on the morphology and the immunophenotype, somebody thought this was a case of CLL. But as I had said to you at the beginning of this, the patient got referred again and we did some additional testing. So there are very subtle differences when you look at the morphology to me. In CLL, most of the time you have classical small lymphocytes with very little cytoplasm. You may have a small number, of admixed larger cells that resemble pro-lymphocytes. So what you can get is what is referred to as a dimorphic type appearance, with a subset of them being large pro-lymphocytes. In mantle cell lymphoma, if you look carefully, what you see is a continuum, a spectrum of cell sizes. The phenotype, though, can be overlapping in some cases. So in the majority of CLL, what you have is dim CD20, dim surface IG expression, and you usually do not see expression of a marker called FMC-7. Mantle cell lymphoma also co-expresses CD5. It has that different morphology, and the spectrum of phenotype is different. But the point that I would make is that most laboratories who do flow and do a lot of flow do not use it to make definitive diagnosis. It is an ancillary test. You never want to look at flow without the morphology. Having said that, there are three types of lymphoid cancers that when they demonstrate the classical phenotype are almost diagnosable without even looking down the microscope. And those are cases of classic CLL, which was not in this case because there was aberrant expression of some markers. The other two diseases are classic hairy cell leukemia with its morphology and its characteristic phenotype. And when you see that, it's almost nothing else it can be. And the third one is precursor B lineage ALL. Strong CD10, strong CD19, absence of CD20, expression of TDT. With the exception of those three diseases, when they present absolutely classical, there are no absolutely robust phenotypes. You see a little bit of variation. Some follicular lymphomas don't express CD10. Roughly 5 to 7% of mantle cell don't express CD5. So if you're relying on expression of one marker to make a definitive diagnosis, you're going to be wrong in a subset of cases. So flow is very useful, especially in peripheral blood and bone marrow. It can help you narrow in on what the likely diagnosis is, but in some circumstances, you need additional testing. Now, in this case, this is a patient who refused to have a bone marrow. Had a bone marrow been done, one could have done some immunohistochemistry on the biopsy or the squash prep, could have done for cyclin D1, could have done for SOX11, etc. Those would have been very valuable. But in this case, because she refused to have a bone marrow, we simply performed routine FISH on the peripheral blood. The FISH turned up the presence of a translocation 1114 that is characteristic of mantle cell lymphoma. When the other clinical workup was done, she did not have lymphadenopathy, but she had mild splenomegaly. And so one could put sort of two and two together to realize this is actually an uncommon form of mantle cell lymphoma that is referred to as the leukemic sort of type. It often has mutations of IG because it's seen in the germinal center and often has, in contrast to typical mantle cell, this can have a very indolent clinical behavior. So this patient was simply watched and waited.
We were talking before about the critical importance of FISH testing in CLL, specifically identifying patients with del17p. What do we know about when that occurs? When you see del17p, is it usually at first diagnosis? Can you see it occur, develop over time?
So it can be a progression event, So if FISH has been done and been done well and it's not present at diagnosis, over time it can appear as a dominant clone because in essence it gets selected for because it provides a growth advantage. But in another subset of patients, it actually will be present in a percentage of cells at the time of diagnosis. So it's important to count sufficient nuclei so that you know it's there. There are some really nice papers that have been out the last few years showing that using next-gen sequencing, we can actually detect it even earlier in cases that might be FISH negative, but in fact harbor mutations as opposed to deletions. And we know that that also has clinical relevance. So that whole test menu is going to open up, and then if it isn't really opened already, into providing valuable information. When you look at the cases that have the presence of the abnormality, but it's below the level of FISH detection, they still will show a characteristic aggressive behavior. So the use of next-gen sequencing and understanding not only deletions, but mutations is becoming really important.
So let's hear about your last patient, the 52-year-old man.
So the 52-year-old man, we'd sort of touched upon a bit of this, but this is a very good example. So this is a man who presented with fatigue and weight loss and had a lump in the groin. There was a biopsy performed at the outside hospital and a diagnosis of DLBCL was rendered. But the patient came into the BC Cancer Agency, of course, as did the accompanying pathology. We reviewed the histology, and we also performed our lymph2CX assay, which isn't stated in the case that I provided, but in fact, this was a germinal center B-cell type lymphoma, and it strongly expressed a marker that we had that the outside hospital didn't, that was MYC. So it strongly expressed the MYC protein and also BCL2 protein. So yes, it was GCB, but it expressed both of those antigens very prominently. For those reasons, the standard operating procedure in our lab, because it's GCB and defined clearly as GCB, we would automatically do FISH testing for MYC, BCL2, and BCL6. We did that in this case, and we turned up dual translocation lymphoma, what is we coined many years ago, double hit. So this was a DLBCL, germinal center B-cell type, that harbored translocations of MYC and BCL2. And as we'd spoke about earlier, in our institution, that would lead to a different treatment paradigm based on age. The patients are younger, they would get Codox MIVAC and be considered for a transplant depending on stage. If the patients are over 65, they would get dose-adjusted EPOCR, which is an infusional therapy. Importantly, both of those options have the issue of dose intensity built in that's much more significant than our CHOP. And so this patient, in fact, the diagnosis in, you know, 214, 215, it would still be called DLBCL, but with dual translocations. In 217, this now defaults into a new category that we refer to as high-grade B-cell lymphoma with translocations of MYC and BCL2, so-called double hit. That then has a totally different connotation for those patients because the expectation of survival with R-CHOP alone would not be good.
Can you talk about the issue of Burkitt or Burkitt-like lymphomas being, you know, misclassified or misdiagnosed?
So if you see cases of classic Burkitt that follow all of the morphologic features are typical, the immunophenotype is typical, the diagnosis then complemented by genetics in most cases is not that difficult. But we realized many years ago that the presence of MYC translocations in a center like where I work at, we would see 5 to 10 cases of classical Burkitt every year. We would see MYC translocations in that subset of DLBCL far more commonly. So MYC as a clinically relevant thing is much more frequent in DLBCL than we see in terms of routine practice in Burkitt lymphoma. So Burkitt lymphoma, when it presents in the typical morphology and phenotype, is not a difficult diagnosis to make. We identified a group of cases many years ago. In 2008, actually, we called them borderline cases that had features intermediate between Burkitt lymphoma and DLBCL. They often were referred to as so-called Burkitt-like lymphoma. And these are the cases where you look at where they're just not garden variety DLBCL, but equally they're not Burkitt lymphoma. They're a little bit of heterogeneity in terms of the morphology. They're not uniform. They're not all beautiful, large, you know, malignant B cells. They're somewhere in between, in the gray zone. And so these were where those terms came from, so-called gray zone or what we used to call Burkitt-like lymphoma. If you look just within those cases that most observers would say fit into something like Burkitt-like lymphoma in the previous era, there's where you would find enriched the cases of double hit lymphoma. You couldn't explain every case as double hit, but probably 60 to 70% of those, if we could agree upon cases as Burkitt-like, would actually harbor the translocations. That diagnostic category now will disappear. And what will appear in 2017, as I mentioned in about a month, will be this category of high-grade B-cell lymphoma with translocations of MYC, BCL2, and or BCL6.
So a couple of entities that I've read about in trying to review this topic, I just want to throw out to you. First, extramedullary presentations of AML mistakenly interpreted as aggressive lymphoma in the absence of screening for myeloid differentiation.
So we'll tell you that doing this for 30 years, you know, the way to be good at making diagnoses is to not throw anything out, to consider all possibilities. And those are blastically looking tumors that can look exactly like a non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And if the phenotype doesn't start to make sense with a panel or an approach where you think it's a lymphoid malignancy, you cannot exclude the possibility of a so-called, you know, they went by all kinds of names. You and I would know them in the old days as chloromas. You have to think of the diagnosis, and thus there is a battery of immunohistochemical tests that can be performed now that would allow you to confidently make that diagnosis. But the biggest problem I see, to be honest with you, is that some people just haven't considered it. So they'll come up with some undifferentiated lymphoid cancer. I'm not quite sure exactly what it is. And it's the main reason is because they haven't considered the possibility of a chloroma. So again, like any good pathologist, you got to have a differential diagnosis. If the things you've done don't fit with the diagnostic, you know, the road you were going down, then take a step back and rethink a case and make sure you order the right things to establish the diagnosis. Because as you know, the treatments are totally different, as is the expectation. Yeah.
Have you seen cases like that?
Oh, goodness, yes. For the average pathologist in the community, that would be an exquisitely difficult diagnosis to consider and to make. But I have, sure, after 30 years, I've seen all kinds of cases like that.
Hmm.
And you can well imagine how happy the clinicians are to have that reconciled.
Absolutely. Yeah. How about high-grade plasmablastic tumors that are misinterpreted as non-hematopoietic because of downregulation of lymphoid cell-associated antigens?
Yeah. So that's another scenario where, again, it's not uncommon to go down a different route because those tumors can sometimes express what we call EMA or epithelial membrane antigen. They often lack CD45 and CD20. So you don't think of a large B-cell lymphoma. They look like they're sort of immunoblast, plasmablast. But again, you have to think of those diagnostic possibilities. We have now on a small battery of other tests that would allow you to distinguish those. Light chain expression is critical. The presence of EBV is important. There are a lot of things that we can do, CD38, et cetera. There are a lot of markers that we can use now to be confident in that diagnosis. But again, it's thinking about it and ordering the appropriate test to consider it in the differential diagnosis. And again, impact for treatments is big.
Any other clinical scenarios that we haven't talked about or issues that you'd like to comment on?
No, I think we've covered quite a spectrum of different diseases and why expertise is important. I would just, again, go back to the point that I made about value for money spent, that a review of that diagnostic biopsy is absolutely critical. The treating clinicians need to be confident that they know what they're dealing with, as the expectation of survival, the treatment plan, et cetera, it's all predicated on starting with an accurate diagnosis.
I'm kind of curious what kind of infrastructure is out there, and I don't know if there have been any discussions about this, to do second hematologic pathology opinions. In general, when I think about it, it's a very kind of haphazard thing. You identify some center that, you know, it's published, et cetera. You start sending their stuff to them. Is there any kind of national or international virtual supported network or more efficient, broader approach to try to deal with this?
So I would say that's a very topical question. Now, you remember that I reside in the country north of you, the 51st state, as some would like to consider it. That's Canada. In Canada, we would like Bernie Sanders in Canada. He would fit in quite well. So, you know, I will tell you that the way we deal with cancer in Canada is that in British Columbia, where I've worked for 30 years, there's a very sort of low threat. You know, there's no issues with referring cases. We don't charge people. They take advantage of the expertise. And for a province of roughly 4.5 million people, or, you know, that's the catchment, we can create the infrastructure and the number of bodies we need to have a high level of expertise and to make those diagnoses in 24 hours uniformly and with high confidence. That serves all the treating clinicians in this province and the patients extremely well. In your country, things are a bit different. But what I would say is that to the community pathologists, and to the treating clinicians out there in the community, you're going to do yourself a lot of good to develop a standard of practice where lymphoid cases are examined by people with expertise, and that it's not a mark against pathologists in a community center remembering the entire spectrum of things they're doing. that they should have a low threshold for wanting to, you know, to send things. They should have no hesitation in sending cases. That expertise that they can find, if they find a consultant that they like and offers a really good program, then I strongly recommend that you should have no hesitation in sending the cases. The patients will be, and the treating clinicians will be the ones that benefit. And it's not a reflection upon your expertise or your ability to practice as a specialist in a smaller community where it's difficult to be good at everything.
We should note that subsequent to this recording, results from the Phase 3 Echelon 1 study were presented at ASH, demonstrating that frontline brentuximab vedotin in combination with AVD significantly improved modified PFS compared to standard of care ABVD in patients with advanced stage Hodgkin lymphoma.